KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. President Trump has talked of not defending NATO allies if they don't pay. We hear from NATO's Secretary General, who says Trump is being even-handed in negotiations between Russia and Ukraine. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. FBI agents arrested a Milwaukee judge accused of helping a man in her court avoid immigration agents. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. What are locals saying about the charges against her? Also, why universities are so dependent on federal research funding, and Chubby Checker twists his way into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. It is Monday, April 28th. On this day in 1967, Muhammad Ali refused to join the army over religious objections. The Supreme Court eventually overturned his criminal conviction. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Russia is declaring a temporary unilateral ceasefire in its war with Ukraine. The truce will run from May 8th through the 10th. That will be when Russia celebrates the 80th anniversary of the end of World War II. The Kremlin is calling on Ukraine to do the same, but a one-day Easter truce called by Russia never took hold. The International Court of Justice in The Hague is examining Israel's ban on the UN agency that aids Palestinians. NPR's Carrie Kahn reports more than 40 countries are urging the court to condemn Israel's actions.
The case focuses on an Israeli law passed last year banning the United Nations Agency for Palestinian Refugees, known as UNRWA. The UN charges the ban is a violation of the charter to which Israel is a signatory. UNRWA is responsible for providing assistance to millions of Palestinians, including in Gaza. The court's hearing comes as a total blockade of aid into Gaza by Israel has been in place for 2 months. The UN's food program says it has no more food to stock charity kitchens, which provide food for half of Gaza's residents. Israel is not attending the court hearing. However, its foreign minister accused the UN of, quote, weaponizing international law to deprive Israel of its most basic right to defend itself. Carrie Kahn, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
President Trump will mark his first 100 days in office starting tomorrow. NPR's Asma Khalid reports the date is considered a milestone as observers take stock of a president's early record.
The idea of measuring a president by what he's done in 100 days is no doubt somewhat arbitrary, but it goes back to the 1930s and Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Trump has acted more swiftly and more aggressively than his first term to enact sweeping change, shrinking the size of the federal government, dismantling agencies, taking over cultural institutions, cracking down on immigrants, and upending the economic system with his tariff plans. But as he's done this, polls show the president's popularity is falling. As he reaches this 100-day milestone, polling shows his approval rating at this point is lower than any other president in recent history. Asma Khalid, NPR News.
Congress is back after a two-week recess. Democrats are protesting a pending budget proposal put forward by Republicans and backed by President Trump. House Democratic leader Hakeem Jeffries says its highlights are devastating for Americans.
This is a tough moment. None of this stuff is normal. Like the assault on the economy, the assault on health care, the assault on Social Security, the assault on veterans, the assault on the American way of life, the assault on democracy and the rule of law. None of this stuff is normal.
Republican lawmakers insist their budget proposal will not harm Americans. Democrats say the GOP cannot do this without slicing into Medicaid very deeply. You're listening to NPR. The Vatican has announced the start date for a papal conclave. It's Wednesday, May 7th. Members of the Roman Catholic College of Cardinals will sequester themselves inside the historic Sistine Chapel. Eligible cardinals will then vote to select the next pope. They will remain sequestered in the Vatican until the next pontiff is chosen. In the U.S., the trial starts today for three former Memphis police officers accused in the beating death of black motorist Tyree Nichols. He was beaten during a traffic stop in 2023 and died later. The beating was recorded on police video and published. Two other accused former officers have also been charged. They are not on trial today. They're expected to change their not guilty pleas. Moose are on the move in Sweden. They've begun their annual migration across the northern part of the country. NPR's Ayanna Archie reports millions of people are tuning in to watch.
Each spring, hundreds of moose journey from their winter hangout spot to their summer one, which is in the mountains near the Sweden-Norway border. They're looking for new food sources as well as a nice place to raise their calves. Since 2019, Swedish public broadcaster SVT has live-streamed the trip. More than 9 million people watched around the world last year, and viewership is expected to be even higher this year. That's according to an executive producer of the live stream. The program is an indication of how popular the slow TV genre has become. Slow TV includes live, unedited, and hours or even months-long coverage of some routine event, usually with a theme or journey in mind. Ayanna Archie, NPR News.
This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Lilly Endowment, a private foundation supporting NPR's coverage of religion and spirituality, and Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Coming up, we hear a defender of the Wisconsin judge accused of helping a man evade immigration authorities.
But first, Russia has announced a three-day ceasefire in Ukraine starting May 8th, when Russia celebrates a national holiday. The announcement comes as the Trump administration says it is still trying to reach a peace deal more than 3 years since Russia's full-on war on Ukraine began. The Trump team's proposal would apparently include Ukraine giving up Crimea, a territory that Russia illegally annexed years ago. But that's a concession that Ukraine has been unwilling to accept. When I spoke earlier with NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte, he suggested a middle way.
There is a difference between acknowledging, stating the fact that part of our country, in case of the Ukrainians, has been captured, in this case by the Russians, and saying now legally they own this. So we really have to make sure that we make that distinction.
Rutte was in Washington last week meeting with President Trump and other top diplomatic and security officials in advance of the annual summit in June for NATO, the world's biggest military alliance. I spoke with him as he was traveling between meetings, and I asked him how they were going, as America seeks to dial back its involvement in many international conflicts.
Yes, we discussed first Ukraine. I think we can all be very happy for the fact that President Trump broke the deadlock and started the talks, and obviously, it is the U.S. and U.S. leadership and Trump's leadership which we need here to bring this to a good end, and including the help from Secretary Hegseth, Rubio, and Security Advisor Walz. So we discussed the state of play on that. I think they're really making progress. The ball is now clearly in Russian's court. So they need to now make proposals, at least react to what is on the table. And we discussed the upcoming NATO summit, which I believe we have every reason to think will be very successful. So much more defense spending, particularly on the European and Canadian side, which is necessary, but also ramping up defense industrial production.
Well, as you just mentioned, in a couple of months, you're going to chair a summit of NATO nations in the Netherlands. You said you believe it will be successful. What does success look like?
For two reasons, I think it will be successful. First of all, because I believe we will decide that the European side of NATO and the Canadian side of NATO will ramp up spending, which is crucial because of the Russian threat, because of the Chinese build-up of its military, but also because it is fair to spend more on that side of NATO because it equalizes with what the US is spending. And rightly, the US has complained, and particularly President Trump has been very clear on this, that he expects the Europeans and Canada to pay more, to step up in terms of their overall defense spending. And that is going to happen. So that will be successful. And then there is an issue around, for the whole of NATO, including the US, that we do not produce enough in terms of defense industrial products. Ammunition, Navy ships, tanks, fighter jets, long-range missiles, and air defense systems, what have you. And we will take decisions in June to make sure that we will stay ahead of the Russians and the Chinese. And that is important to keep ourselves safe.
Turning to some specific conflicts, though, there are European leaders, both publicly and privately, have expressed some shock at what seems to be an American tilt toward Russia in these negotiations over the war, which it started in Ukraine, seem to be pressing Ukraine to make concessions, even as by some lights that the U.S. in the current administration doesn't seem to be pressing Russia as hard. Is that your view as well?
It is not. No, I think the U.S. is really trying to, and President Trump's team and he himself really tried to, in an even-handed way, bring this whole process forward. It will mean compromises on all sides. What we have seen last, the attack on Kyiv, a residential area, people just going about their lives, 12 people killed, because of an indiscriminate attack by the Russians on that part of Kyiv. But also I was in Odessa the other week with President Zelensky, and I've seen the devastation there when attacks take place and these missiles come in this beautiful city. This is not a sign of strength by the Russians. If they really are winning this, they would not do this. It is clearly a sign of the weakness on the Russian side.
Ukraine's desire to seek NATO membership is a part of these discussions. Is that officially off the table now, to your understanding, or is that still part of the discussion?
No, there is a clear statement by NATO that there is an irreversible path for Ukraine into NATO, but we always knew that there were very different views among allies. NATO is very much involved in building up the Ukrainian armed forces, helping with making sure that all the support for Ukraine, military support for Ukraine, is well coordinated. When it comes to full NATO membership, we never promised Ukraine that will be part of a peace deal.
Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth back in February warned that the U.S. is increasingly focused on Asia and its own borders for security. Did you walk away from this meeting feeling confident that the United States is still committed to NATO, even if it sort of reorders its priorities?
100% on both issues. One, the membership of NATO and a total commitment to Article 5. I was 4 weeks ago also visiting President Trump in the White House, and he was very clear on this. Obviously, the U.S. has to take care of more issues than only Europe and the Euro-Atlantic. There's also the Middle East. There's also the Indo-Pacific. So whilst the Europeans are stepping up, spending more, making sure that we can deliver more of the overall capabilities we need to deliver as NATO as a whole, that it's only logical for the U.S. To pivot more towards Asia. But I'm absolutely convinced we will do this in a step-by-step approach. But it's only logical. Everybody understands that.
That is NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte. Mr. Secretary General, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you so much for having me on the program.
Trump administration officials say nobody is above the law, which is why they say the FBI arrested a Wisconsin judge. They accused Milwaukee County Circuit Judge Hannah Dugan of ushering a person without legal status out of a side exit of her courtroom to evade immigration agents who wanted to arrest him. The man was charged with domestic violence at the time. That's why he was in court. Dugan has been released until her next court hearing, but hundreds of protesters have been demonstrating outside the FBI building in Milwaukee, and one of them is on the line, Ryan Clancy, who is a Democratic member of the State Assembly. Mr. Clancy, welcome to the program.
Steve, thanks so much for having me and covering this.
Granting that you're not a witness, you're gathering information from the media or whatever, like the rest of us, do you agree on the basic facts of what seems to have happened here, that there's a Mexican migrant in her court that ICE agents ask for him. The Judge Dugan gets upset about this and lets him out the side door.
I think some of those facts are in dispute, and I think there's a significant difference here between an administrative warrant, which is what ICE said and admitted that they have in their complaint, which is essentially an internal document, and an actual warrant signed by an actual judge. And I'm very grateful that Judge Dugan recognized the difference and acted accordingly. She just stood up for our community here.
Oh, now this is very interesting, because you could imagine the judge saying, well, someone saying, well, the judge has an obligation to cooperate with the law enforcement authorities, the federal authorities who appear in front of her. But you're saying that you're arguing that they may have had less than full authority to demand full cooperation from the judge?
Absolutely. They did not have a real warrant signed by a real judge. Essentially, an administrative warrant from ICE is a piece of paper that they produce themselves saying they can do what they want. It doesn't have the same power as an actual warrant does. And Judge Dugan, as a judge herself, apparently realized that and did what I hope any of us would do, which is standing up for members of our community who are being targeted by the Trump regime.
Didn't work out for him. I mean, the authorities chased the guy down after he went out the side door, and they arrested him anyway.
They did, and that is it has a really profound and negative chilling effect. Courthouses and courtrooms specifically have been protected spaces, just like operating rooms, classrooms. You don't want law enforcement, you don't want ICE specifically operating without impunity in those areas. And my concern here, and we've already started to see this, is that people who would normally be willingly participating in the justice system are now going to think twice if they think that, you know, showing up either as a defendant or a witness may lead to their own arrest.
Can you tell me, though, what ICE should have done? They have this federal policy to deport people. That is also the law, that people who are not here legally should not be here legally. They are supposed to get this guy. What should they have done? Should they have just left him in the courthouse? Should they have ignored him, tried to find him somewhere else? What should they have done?
Certainly. I mean, I do not think that ICE should be deporting people at all. We have done without ICE for many years. And even prior to that, there's been a longstanding tradition for good reason of not going into those safe, protected spaces. So we can debate whether or not ICE should be deporting people at all. They should not. ICE should be abolished. That said, they absolutely should not be going into courtrooms. That has a chilling effect both on people that are there to participate and also elected and appointed officials like judges who are clearly being targeted by this administration as well.
I want to make sure that I understand what you're telling me. You're not saying ICE should not be deporting people from courts, which is a point of view. You're saying ICE should not be deporting people? Just anybody should come here for any reason and nobody should enforce the law?
That's a larger issue. I mean, certainly we do not have significant legal pathways for folks who want to do the right thing and want to be here and join our American society in the right way. And it is frustrating for people to hear, you know, oh, they should be doing it the right way. There are many, many people who are integrated into our communities, who are part of our communities, who are trying to do the right thing and are trying to get legal status. Despite the fact that we make it really difficult at the federal level, we should not be deporting those people either. And okay, to be very clear, ICE should not exist. ICE should be abolished.
Understand your point of view there. Like, getting back to the judge now, are you concerned about where this is going with the judge being arrested given these circumstances?
Absolutely. And this is incredibly unprecedented. A functioning democracy does not arrest sitting judges for doing their job, not for doing anything criminal or illegal. And they certainly don't, you know, handcuff them and then perp walk them in front of cameras. The goal here clearly is a chilling effect. It's to stop people from, you know, doing their jobs and standing up for community when they are standing up to the Trump regime.
Ryan Clancy is a Wisconsin state representative, member of the Democratic Party, Assembly District 19, which includes part of Milwaukee. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Steve. Appreciate you.
This is NPR News. Thank you.
On the next Fresh Air, a conversation with author and executive Daria Burke. She'll talk about her new memoir, Of My Own Making, which explores her growing up in 1980s Detroit amid addiction and instability, and the years she spent trying to outrun that past by building a carefully curated, outwardly successful life. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Proven Winners, with Proven Winners Color Choice Shrubs, offering flowering shrubs and evergreens for gardens and landscapes at garden centers nationwide. ProvenWinnersColorChoice.com/NPR. From the Kresge Foundation, established 100 years ago, the Kresge Foundation works to expand equity and opportunity in cities across America. A century of impact, a future of opportunity. More at Kresge.org. From Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, which monitors safe driving habits to determine a personalized rate at progressive.com, not available in California or from all agents. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. The federal government has canceled about $11 billion worth of university research funding and is threatening to cut more. NPR's Alyssa Nadworny reports that when the federal government stops funding research, there's really no one else to take on those costs.
In the first 3 months of Donald Trump's presidency, dozens of colleges and universities had their federal research grants frozen. Some funds were canceled because of the shuttering of federal departments like USAID and the U.S. Department of Education. Others were halted in response to alleged anti-Semitism on campus. Cancer research, diabetes, research in new wearable technology, farming solutions, early childhood development, and domestic violence. Research across nearly every discipline and subject.
The government-university industry partnership for R&D built the American economy in the 20th century.
Shailen Jotishi is the managing director of the Future of Work and Innovation Economy Initiative at New America, a left-leaning think tank. After World War II, he says the federal government entrusted and deeply invested in universities to conduct research and development.
Everything from the iPhone to GPS technology to fortified vitamin D has had its roots in federally funded research.
In 2021, the federal government gave colleges and universities about $180 billion across dozens of federal agencies, according to the Government Accountability Office, a government watchdog.
American research universities have been the envy of the world for a reason. China and other competitors of the United States are borrowing from the American playbook for innovation.
Jotishi says that the biggest worry is that if the government gets out of this business, there won't be anyone to step in.
Industry cannot and will not pick up the mantle of the public sector in supporting the R&D enterprise.
Sabrina Howell, a finance professor at NYU's business school, studies innovation and university research.
We would not have iPhones if universities like MIT that are federally government funded hadn't worked on lasers.
That laser technology wasn't just used on the iPhone. It helped create semiconductors that essentially power everything we use all day long.
No private company would take on their own, both because it's really expensive. It's not obvious what the commercial application is for all the work that you're doing. And so only government can fund that kind of work.
While the Trump administration talks about handing this work off to the private sector, Howell says it's just too expensive to fund that without a clear return on investment. Her research shows that's because industry has a different motivation on outputs. But there are experts who think changes could be made to this partnership.
It's time for someone to shake things up a bit.
Richard Vedder is a senior fellow at the Independent Institute, a libertarian think tank. He's written about scaling back government funding for research overhead and administration. And while he says Trump's arbitrary cuts aren't what he had in mind, it's definitely sending an important message to colleges.
It's not perhaps the ideal way to change things. It may be a disruptive way to change things. But on the whole, the attempt to reevaluate research grant money is a valid one.
He says maybe now that the public sees the high price tag of federally funded research, there will be a way to make changes or disruptions without abruptly halting essential and life-saving research. Alyssa Nadworny, NPR News.
A new batch of musicians is heading to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, including a major 80s pop star, a groundbreaking Southern rap duo, and a 60s dance icon who spent years lobbying for his own induction. NPR's Isabella Gomez-Sarmiento has the rundown.
There are seven performers who will join the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame this year. They joined the 255 artists who are already in the hall, ranging from rock and roll founders like Chuck Berry and Elvis Presley through 21st century artists like Missy Elliott. In recent years, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame has expanded the definition of its namesake genre, but it's still letting in straight ahead rock acts like the classic rockers, Bad Company. I can't get enough of your love. Bad Company has been eligible since 1999, but was nominated for the first time this year. Grunge pioneers Soundgarden are also on the list. Heat, so is the legendary Southern rap duo Outkast. Made up of Big Boi and Andre 3000, Outkast put Atlanta on hip-hop's map with albums like 18 Aliens, Stankonia, and Speakerbox, The Love Below. This year, they'll be inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. So will the rainbow-haired pop star Cyndi Lauper, who rose to stardom on 80s dance floors and on MTV with hits like this one. If you love, you can look and you will find me. Time after time. Also getting inducted is the late English singer Joe Cocker. Lend me your ears and I'll sing you a song. Cocker became a star in the U.S. with this raspy rendition of the Beatles song With a Little Help from My Friends at Woodstock in 1969. But he went on to release more than 40 albums, spawning hits like Feeling All Right and You Are So Beautiful. Artists are eligible for the Rock Hall 25 years after their first commercial release, and the youngest by that criteria is the White Stripes. The guitar, drums, and vocal duo were at the forefront of the garage rock revival of the early 2000s. The artist who waited the longest for his nomination is Chubby Checker. He danced his way to the very top of the Billboard Hot 100 with this cover of The Twist in 1960. Come on, baby. Let's do the twist. In 2001, Chubby Checker took out a full-page ad in Billboard magazine saying he felt underappreciated for his contributions to rock and roll. He adamantly requested his own induction into the Rock Hall, writing, quote, I want my flowers while I'm alive. I can't smell them when I'm dead. It's been more than two decades, but the bouquet is finally on its way. Each year, in addition to the inductees named by the Hall's voters, a few musicians are also included as musical influences. This year's honored artists are the groundbreaking female rap group Salt-N-Pepa and the 70s and 80s rock songwriter Warren Zevon. The Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction ceremony will take place on November 8th in Los Angeles. Isabella Gomez-Sarmiento, NPR News.
It's NPR News.
After college, deaf students are less likely to find jobs in the sciences, healthcare, or teaching, and government grants that aim to change that were just ended by the Trump administration.
I definitely feel like if things had been different, I wouldn't be feeling so lost and unsure about my future.
I'm Ari Shapiro. The uncertainty ahead for students on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. As the Trump administration continues to pressure Russia to accept a U.S. peace proposal in Ukraine, Russian President Vladimir Putin has announced a three-day ceasefire with Kyiv. Putin says his forces will halt hostilities May 8th through 10th to mark the 80th anniversary of the end of World War II. Over the weekend, President Trump met with Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky for about 15 minutes at St. Peter's Basilica ahead of the funeral for Pope Francis. The Pope died a week ago today of heart failure at the age of 88 following a stroke that left him in a coma. At the Vatican today, it was announced the conclave to elect a new pope will begin May 7th at the Sistine Chapel. The Drug Enforcement Administration says more than 100 migrants who were in the U.S. without legal status were arrested in a weekend raid in Colorado. Here's NPR's Joel Rose.
The Drug Enforcement Administration shared video and details about this raid that took place at what the DEA called an underground nightclub in Colorado Springs in the early morning hours of Sunday. The DEA says several hundred people were in the club at the time, including 114 immigrants without legal status who were arrested. This would be one of the largest single enforcement actions since President Trump took office.
That's NPR's Joel Rose. This is NPR News. President Trump's border czar, Tom Homan, says he supports the FBI arresting a judge in Wisconsin last Friday for allegedly helping a man without legal status in the U.S. to evade immigration authorities from her courtroom.
When you cross that line to impediment or knowingly harboring, concealing an illegal alien ICE, you will be prosecuted.
Homan was speaking this morning at a White House briefing. Milwaukee County Circuit Court Judge Hannah Dugan is scheduled to be back in court next month for a preliminary hearing. She denies the accusation. Former Vice President Kamala Harris will be speaking in Northern California later this week. NPR's Deepa Shivaram says Harris has been largely out of the public spotlight since leaving office.
Harris will be speaking from a gala event in San Francisco for Emerge, an organization that helps women run for office. She'll be critical of Trump's economic policies and celebrate those who are trying to stand up to the administration. Harris's remarks come as Trump hits 100 days of his second term. Harris has remained in Los Angeles since inauguration and has infrequently been in the public eye. Though her name has been on several fundraising emails for the Democratic Party, she hasn't weighed in on Trump's actions since taking office, and this speech will mark a turning point. Deepa Shivaram, NPR News.
Stocks on Wall Street opened higher moments ago. The Dow is up 205 points. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Capital One with the Capital One Saver Card. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. From the Cy Sims Foundation, since 1985, supporting advances in science, education, and the arts towards a fairer, more just, and civil society. More information is available at CySimsFoundation.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. We're going to spend a few minutes this morning on news from Canada, including the national election happening today. But first, a man in Vancouver has been charged with 8 counts of murder after he drove an SUV into a crowd at a Filipino cultural festival on Saturday night. At least 11 people were killed. Police say it was not a terrorist attack, but there are still plenty of questions about how and why it happened. NPR's Becky Sullivan has this report.
It had been a beautiful spring Saturday afternoon in Vancouver for the city's new annual Lapu-Lapu Day Festival. It was a Filipino street party tied to a holiday in the Philippines that celebrates a historic indigenous victory over Spanish troops back in the 1500s. Saturday's block party in Vancouver had dozens of food trucks and vendors, and thousands of people were in attendance. But by sundown, the scene had turned into a nightmare. Around 8:15 p.m., a man driving a black SUV sped into a crowd of hundreds milling between two rows of food trucks and vendor stalls. Videos circulating on social media showed the chaotic aftermath, with bodies laying on the pavement and bystanders caring for the wounded. Chris Pongilinan was working one of the booths and described what he saw in an interview with the CBC.
It was like seeing a bowling ball hit all the bowling pins and all the pins go flying up in the air. It looked like we were in a war zone.
In addition to the dead, dozens were injured.
This is the darkest day in our city's history.
This is Vancouver's acting police chief Steve Rye speaking to reporters Sunday. The victims' ages ranged from 5 to 65 years old, he said.
There are many unanswered questions about why this horrific crime happened, the motive of the person who did it, and whether anything could have been done to prevent it.
Police identified the driver as 30-year-old Vancouver resident Kai G. Adam Lowe. He was detained by bystanders at the scene, then taken into police custody. City officials, including Mayor Ken Sim, said Sunday they were still trying to figure out the motive.
Evidence points to this not being an act of terrorism. The individual in question has a significant history of mental health issues. He is known to police for a multitude of mental health interactions.
Authorities did not elaborate on the man's previous interactions with police, except to say they were, quote, significant. Becky Sullivan, NPR News.
Canadians vote today in an election to decide the country's next prime minister. Much of the campaigning has been about which candidate can best handle President Trump. NPR International Affairs correspondent Jackie Northam reports from Nova Scotia.
At a recent political rally in the northern Canadian city of Edmonton, thousands of supporters gave a rousing welcome to Pierre Poilievre, leader of the Conservative political party and one of the main candidates in the country's upcoming election. Edmonton is the capital of Alberta, a western prairie province considered to be the Texas of Canada, big on oil and gas and cattle. Here, Poilievre's stand against immigration, big government, and the ruling Liberal Party resonated with supporters like Tegan Reimer.
I'm attending the Pierre rally because I'm sick of the Liberal government for the past 9 years and I want some change.
For months, Poilievre's poll numbers were crusting, while Prime Minister Justin Trudeau's numbers were rock bottom. Poilievre was almost guaranteed a landslide victory in Canada's next election. Almost.
Within an instant, events changed.
David Coletto is founder and CEO of Abacus Data, a Canadian polling firm. He says in January, things started to unravel for Poilievre.
The primary villain was Justin Trudeau. He left. A new villain emerged, bigger, more scary, external to the country in Donald Trump.
Shortly after his inauguration, President Trump started targeting Canada, imposing steep tariffs and threatening its sovereignty.
I think Canada is going to be a very serious contender to be our 51st state.
Trump's taunts and threats outraged many Canadians and led to a rise in nationalism. But Trump's comments also threw a bright spotlight on Poilievre.
Many people in Canada have associated a lot of the language, a lot of the terminology, speaking points that Pierre Poilievre uses to exactly what Donald Trump has been saying.
Robert Hewish is a social science professor at Dalhousie University in Halifax.
Canada first, migration is a bad thing, stronger borders, budget cuts, all the stuff that you would hear Trump sort of doing, Poilievre has really adapted.
And that association with Trump has hurt Poilievre badly. In January, Poilievre and his Conservative Party were up in the polls, at one point 27 points ahead. But in a stunning turnaround, the Liberals have roared back, and most polls show they're now slightly ahead of the Conservatives. Coletto says Poilievre's setback has benefited Trudeau's successor, Prime Minister Mark Carney.
Mark Carney, the new Liberal leader and Prime Minister, emerged at a moment where I think more and more Canadians were looking for somebody with his experience, with his demeanor, with his approach to politics.
Carney has a financial background on Wall Street as governor of the Bank of England during the turmoil of Brexit and as head of the Bank of Canada. But Poilievre says Carney has the same troubled policies as Trudeau. That came up during the election debates, like this one broadcast on global television.
And we're in a very different.
So far, Carney seems to have a better relationship with Trump than Trudeau did, and his popularity has helped Liberal candidates across Canada. I met up with Jessica Fancy Landry at a cozy cafe in Lunenburg. She's a first-time candidate running as a Liberal in a small district here in the Maritime Province of Nova Scotia.
People know that this is a historic election. I don't think that there's ever been an election that means more to Canada.
Fancy Landry says voters pepper her with questions about the impact of Trump and his policies on Canada.
Definitely tariffs have been discussed and questioned, and a lot of it is bewilderment.
Jared Wesley, a political scientist at the University of Alberta in Edmonton, says the upcoming Canadian election needs to be about more than just Trump and his policies.
We aren't talking about social policy issues a heck of a lot, and we aren't talking about the environment. Those have been crowded out.
But with a powerful neighbor targeting the country, Canadian voters can't ignore the impact of Trump on the election. Jackie Northam, NPR News, Lunenburg, Nova Scotia.
This afternoon on All Things Considered, what do autistic people think about the way Robert F. Kennedy Jr. describes them? There is a very wide range of autistic people. About a quarter are profoundly affected, and we will hear the leader of the National Council on Severe Autism. Tell your smart speaker to play your local station by name, or listen to the NPR app, or turn on the radio. This is NPR News.
Canadians go to the polls to choose their next prime minister. Incumbent Mark Carney leads the race. We will have what's coming next time on Here and Now.
With everything from groceries to orthodontics, yes, really, available on demand, why not public radio? Make playing NPR or this station part of your smart speaker routine to stay informed on your schedule.
Good morning, I'm Michelle Martin. Back in August 2020, the LaFleur family boarded up most of the windows to their home in Louisiana to prepare for a hurricane. 2 months later, things were getting back to normal, but one day after work, something was missing. Their six-year-old dog, Kingston. They searched, but finally accepted he was gone. Then last month, they got an email that Kingston had been found at a frat house 300 miles away in Mississippi. When they got there, Kingston ran into their arms, but not before Kappa Sigma made him a member. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station
and from the Nature Conservancy, committed to protecting and preserving the planet during Earth Month and every month through the bold power of local and global action. nature.org/NPR. From Fisher Investments, as a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Next, we meet some of the people affected by a number in the news.
That number is 884. That is the number of confirmed cases of measles in the United States this year, according to the Centers for Disease Control. So it's April, and we've already tripled the number of cases from last year. Officials also say vaccine hesitancy is a factor in the resurgence.
Measles is in 30 U.S. states now, and we have a view of it this morning in one hard-hit county in Texas. Brad Burt with member station KTTZ went there. Hi there, Brad.
Hey, Steve. Thanks for having me.
Glad you're with us. Where'd you go?
So I was in Gaines County last week, where a little less than half of all the measles cases in the country have been confirmed, 393 to be exact. What I saw was children playing out at a park in Seminole there, people coming in and out of a coffee shop on Main Street. But meanwhile, the MMR vaccine clinic set up by the South Plains Health District was empty. Zach Holbrooks, director for the district, says vaccine hesitancy has remained an obstacle to ending that outbreak.
It's a lot of groups that are hesitant. So all we can do is provide the venue for people to either get tested, screened, or get the vaccine.
At the beginning of the year, the vaccination rate for this county was 82%. The Centers for Disease Control says at least 95% vaccination rate is needed to prevent outbreaks.
I appreciate that perspective. The vast majority of people in this vaccine-hesitant county are actually not vaccine-hesitant. They've taken the vaccine, but some are not, and that leads to this problem. So what's being done?
Well, local health authorities set up a pop-up clinic in a building where livestock shows are normally held, and billboards and local TV ads encourage people to get vaccinated. There's messaging in English, Spanish, and actually Low German for the local Mennonite community. And yet many here still don't trust vaccines. Pediatrician Dr. Anna Montanez says some parents have chosen to forgo the vaccine for other unproven remedies like vitamin A.
That is our biggest nemesis, right, is misinformation, at least from, you know, healthcare perspective. I struggle with that every single day with almost every patient that I see.
Now, Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. previously endorsed vitamin A as a treatment for measles. He has since stepped back from that and has recommended the best treatment as the MMR vaccine.
So you have a longtime vaccine skeptic, maybe the top vaccine skeptic in the country, saying the vaccine is good in this case, but I guess that comes too late for some people. So how has this affected especially children?
Yeah, most of the cases in Texas are children. The two deaths so far in West Texas were children. And you have to ask why that would be. Well, here's an intriguing number. About 18% of students in public schools in this county claim conscientious exemption to required vaccines, and that's provided by state law. Dr. Montanez insists that vaccination is the best prevention, but she says an ounce of protection is worth way more than a pound of cure. She also says when she engages skeptics and answers their questions about alternative remedies like vitamin A, many have become more open to safer decisions. And when I was in Seminole, families continued to go about their daily lives. Schools were open, businesses were open, and the virus continues to spread.
Brad Burt with KTTZ in Lubbock, Texas. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
This is NPR News. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Women are making a lot of noise in popular music today. Think Beyonce, Taylor Swift, Shania Twain. But when was the last time you heard a piece of classical music composed by a woman? In her new album, French violinist Esther Abrami uncovers what women have had to say musically, from the Middle Ages Hildegard von Bingen to Miley Cyrus today, dipping into Brazilian dances and, yes, pop along the way. She spoke with me from Paris about what first inspired her.
It's when I came out of university and I was 25 years old that it hit me that in all those years I'd learned hundreds of pieces, but not a single one of them had been written by a woman. Then I started kind of doing my own journey and my own research with it. And it was like opening the door of like a hidden treasure.
Do you think that women have something different to say than men in music?
On my side, what I've kind of found, I think, is that a lot of the music that we have from men is often linked to something like war. You know, heroic music. And I think what you compose is really what you live. And the life of women were very different. So I think the fact that women didn't really have the opportunity to have their pieces performed by full orchestras also mean that a lot of the time they were composing for more intimate ensembles. It's very powerful, but another kind of power.
A number of the composers on this album are names you just don't hear very often, like the Irish composer Ina Boyle. You play her violin concerto. So how did you find them, and then how did you decide to choose them for this album?
The way I found these pieces was really just doing a lot of research, anything I could find, really. I guess I chose those women not only because of their incredible music, but also because of their story.
So that leads me to Vigala, is it, by Ilse Weber?
Yes.
She was Jewish. She was a prisoner at a concentration camp during World War II in what was then the Nazi-occupied Czechoslovakia. A very powerful story.
Ilse Weber was sent to Theresienstadt's prisoner's camp, and she was sent with her and her husband and her son. And she was working as a nurse for the children in the camps. What she was doing was composing music and singing to them. After a while, they decided to send the children to Auschwitz. She took the decision to go to Auschwitz with them. She didn't have to go. And before she left, her husband, who was working as a gardener in this camp, took all of Ilse Weber's music and buried it and hid it. It is known that just before going in the gas chamber, one of the last song lullaby that she sang together with the children was Vigala, this piece that I rearranged and recorded. And after the war, her husband came back and digged out the music, and it's thanks to that we have this today. We have actual testimony from people who came back from the camps who said how much her singing to the prisoners helped.
So on a happier note, one of the composers on your album, Pauline Viardot, was a, well, I guess we would call her an influencer today in the 19th century. What was her impact on the musical world at the time?
It was huge, and I think that's one important thing to know, is that a lot of women, even though they are completely unknown today, they were very popular during their lifetime. And Pauline was hosting concerts and parties, and all the big figures at the time knew her. And she was very good friend with Georges Sand, Chopin, Robert Schumann, and all these people were coming to play with her, to see her.
I think this is a good place to mention that you too, I understand you don't love the word influencer, but you have an enormous following online, including on TikTok. You know, how did that start? Did it just seem natural to you? It's kind of your people?
Well, it actually came from a point of feeling quite lonely. Being a classical musician means that you spend hours and hours locked in a practice room alone. And that's how I started social media. I enjoy sharing moments of my life as a classical musician that people don't ever see when you just go see a classical musician in a concert. And I suddenly have people, you know, who were enjoying viewing these videos, listening to my music. And that really gave me a lot of courage and a lot of motivation also to kind of keep working.
One of the things that you've explored on this album is the difficulty that some of these women had in being heard. You know, you're still in your 20s. Do you still feel that way?
I think the barriers are less obvious. And whilst there's been a huge amount of progress, we are so far off still. That's also the reason why I do social media, is because I see the impact that it has on little girls that come to my concert. They're coming to me saying, oh, I played a piece composed by a woman. So there's still a long way to change things, but I see it changing, and that's beautiful.
That is a violinist, Esther Abrami. Her new album is Women. Esther Abrami, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.